Welcome to the Ohio Star Podcast. I'm your host, Neil W. McCabe. I am the national political editor of the Star News Network, a constellation of 11 state-focused news sites, including the Ohio Star. This week, you will hear my conversation with Star reporter Peter DeBrasco about the court challenge to Ohio's Born Alive bill. Peter also talks to me about his story about a report by the Internet Accountability Project about, wait for it, hypocrisy by the social media giants. Next, you'll hear from Ohio Republican strategist Matt Palumbo. I'm very happy to have him back on. He was on our first podcast episode, and he has a great sense of what's going on in the Ohio Senate race on the Republican side. Earlier this week, President Joseph R. Biden Jr. delivered his first State of the Union address. I spoke to GOP strategist Brian H. Darling about it. Brian is my oldest friend in Washington since we were in the UMass College Republicans together. Brian was a longtime Senate staffer for North Carolina's Jesse Helms, New Hampshire's Brian Smith, and most recently, Kentucky's Rand Paul. After Brian, we'll hear from Ryan Lanier, who runs state affairs for Citizens Against Government Waste. Citizens Against Government Waste was founded by one of my heroes, Peter Grace, and Ryan talks to me about a privacy bill that is now at the Ohio State House. Well, let's kick this thing off with Star reporter Peter DeBrasco. Peter, how's it going?
It's going great, Neil. How are you?
Phenomenal and getting better every day. I'm pumped and jacked about the world. Everything seems to be coming up roses. Like, it just seems like everything is working out perfectly, and we're living in, it's almost like a golden age.
Well, I suppose as long as you're not in Eastern Europe, that is true.
Yeah. So before we talk about more international things, what about, there's a bill in Ohio that you're writing about, SB 157, the Born Alive bill. Did I get the title right? And what is this bill about?
Yeah, you got it right. It's actually already been passed and signed into law by Governor Mike DeWine. The bill is sort of nicknamed the Born Alive bill. It's meant to prevent abortion doctors from killing infants who are born during botched abortions. So naturally, since the people on the left are a bit demonic this way, Planned Parenthood, the ACLU, and a Dayton Women's Health, I think that's misnamed, center, are suing the DeWine administration in order to block the law from going into effect. It's supposed to go into effect on March 23rd, and they're coming in on with a challenge in sort of the 11th hour.
Well, This is all right. This is my problem. As I stumbled through this, this is my problem. I thought that once a baby was out of the womb, it was a person and was legally like just like everyone else. So I can't walk down Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody in the face, just like I can't kill a baby that's been born a minute. Like, why do we need a new law? I thought, you know what I thought? Like, what, like 10 minutes, an hour? Like, how long does a baby have to live before it's protected by laws that are already on the books?
Well, this seems to be obviously the position of the Republicans in Ohio who drafted and passed this bill. That's their exact question. Why is it okay to essentially murder an infant? And the only counter argument I think that I can think of is that, well, the baby was supposed to be aborted anyway, which of course is ridiculous. And so it really is kind of a sickening thing here that they're doing. And by the way, this lawsuit, to avoid sort of discussing this sickening thing that the left wants to do here, which is allow you to kill a baby that was born alive, they're masking it in sort of what I would call the other half or the other third of the law, they're masking their lawsuit in this, which bans professors or doctors who work at publicly funded schools, universities, from taking private contracts to do abortions at, you know, a private abortion center. So essentially what they're saying is you can't work at a public university and teach in med school and or be a doctor and, you know, teach classes, but then also turn around and go provide abortions for a private abortion clinic because they say, you know, then the state is effectively funding or paying somebody who provides abortions. And of course, the universities are funded by the taxpayer, and that might be a violation of the conscience of the taxpayer because they're, you know, unwittingly sort of funding abortion providers or paying abortion providers.
Well, that sounds great. That's like really brilliant. I hadn't even thought of that.
It really is a good bill from a conservative standpoint. But of course, you know, the left is really hyping up that point of the bill and not the main sort of central part of the bill, which is the born alive part of it, right? So they're trying to get it stamped out sort of on different grounds than what the bill is really all about. They're trying to get it stamped out on the caveat, you know, with the medical school doctors instead of, you know, arguing that you should be able to murder a baby when it's born.
Yeah, and I think what's happened in Ohio is that all of the conservative Democrats have now come over to the Republican side, and so there's no longer any kind of split. And Governor John Kasich could get away with vetoing an anti-abortion bill and sort of like just say there was some kind of legal thing or some kind of clause he didn't like, or, you know, I support it, but there's some kind of technicality. But today in Ohio, Governor DeWine cannot veto an anti-abortion bill and expect to get reelected. And of course, he's up. Well, he's got a May 3rd primary. And of course, if he wins the primary, he's up in November. But it just goes to show you the dynamic that's changed in Ohio. And it's one of the themes of the podcast is that, you know, this was a battleground state. And not only is it no longer a battleground state, but it is an adamantly pro-life state.
Yes, that's right. I think that Ohio is becoming reliably red. We saw it in the last two elections. And, you know, frankly, the Ohioans should be proud of their work. And liberal Ohioans hopefully will realize the error of their ways and come to not support things like murdering infants after they're born, and other sort of left-wing globalist, you know, big tech type stuff for the censoring conservatives. Hopefully, the left will learn the error of their ways, though I'm not sure that I'm optimistic about it.
Yeah, well, you mentioned big tech, and there's another story you're working on, and it involves the Internet Accountability Project, and they're calling out the hypocrisy of big tech. Hashtag shocked. What's that story, Peter?
Yeah, so the Internet Accountability Project released a statement on Wednesday which said that essentially, you know, Vladimir Putin and Kremlin officials are still allowed to use big tech platforms like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and Google and so forth, despite the fact that they're committing a what some might call a violent insurrection against the government of Ukraine, the people of Ukraine, which, you know, not only is hypocritical because they banned, for example, Alexei Navalny, who was the Putin opposition leader, from their platform, but it's also hypocritical because they ban conservatives for disinformation all the time, quote-unquote disinformation all the time. They ban American conservatives for that. And the Kremlin is literally, you know, probably the world capital for disinformation. yet they get to stay on these platforms. Of course, you know, President Trump is banned from all these big tech platforms because he supposedly encouraged the quote-unquote insurrection, but Vladimir Putin gets to stay. It's hard to make sense of that, and that's what the Internet Accountability Project is saying. I'm not sure what will become of this. Will Twitter and those folks take action against the Kremlin? Probably not. I wouldn't bet on it. But, you know, the press release basically says that the big tech monopolists are globalists who are opposed to American interests and are essentially on the side of Russia here.
Well, I've been spending a lot more time on Getter and Truth Social. My handle is Reporter McCabe, and it's just sort of a refreshing place because you just don't, there's just not the same nastiness and that I find over on the Twitter side. But I did go, you know, I went over to the, I spent a lot of time on the Twitter side during the Ottawa trucker protest just because I, you know, I just wanted to see what all those left-wing lunatic, you know, reporters, basically government hacks working for the Canadian government were up to. But, you know, the Taliban is on Twitter. Like, there's a lot of people, there are a lot of very evil, nasty people who are on Twitter. You know, and so I didn't realize it. So the leading opponent to Putin is banned on Twitter, but Putin isn't.
That's correct. The leading opponent to Putin is also in jail. He's a political prisoner.
Not just Twitter jail, which I've been in Twitter jail twice.
Yeah, I was in Twitter jail many times before I put Twitter itself in jail. Yeah, Alexei Navalny. Not only was he put in real jail, he was put in Twitter jail, which is amazing. I mean, if you're really pro democracy, like these big tech companies claim they are, and if you really think that Donald Trump and his supporters are anti democracy, like these big tech companies think they are, then what are they doing in Russia? Why are they banning the pro democracy people there instead of, you know, helping them or letting them thrive? And it really is, I mean, it's not a mystery, right? Once again, these companies are evil. They are not grounded in any kind of morality. They will do and say whatever they have to do in order to remain profitable. And obviously, I think the profitable thing for them to do here is to not ban anybody in Russia. It's a giant country. It provides a massive amount of users for Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and so forth. So, of course, they're not going to take action against Russia, especially not, you know, on behalf of Ukraine, which is what, like a 1/100th of the size of Russia, right? And doesn't provide them with any kind of meaningful revenue, meaningful to them, you know.
Yeah, it's I think that the Ukraine will have less leverage on the international stage in the coming months and years. And we'll see how that shakes out. But is there any place where people can find you on social media, Peter, if they looked anywhere?
There's not. I've gotten rid of my social media. I feel great. I would encourage everybody to do the same. you can find me on our news network. You'll have to check out all of our celestial themed papers. I'm kind of all over the place.
Have
I do a lot of work.
We just opened the Connecticut Star. Have you been in the Connecticut Star? I think you were, right?
I have. I've written it.
What did you put in the Nutmeg State?
I put Governor Ned Lamont did a really goofy visit to Glastonbury High School on the first day that masks were optional in the school, and he was like standing outside the school awkwardly as the kids left, and he was like trying to shake their hands, and they were like, "Who's this old dude?" And he was asking them, "Hey, how'd it go on the first mask optional day?" And he really got ridiculed for it by the internet because it was just so obviously a performative thing for an election year for him. He's up for re-election too, and so I wrote about that. It was very strange and so obviously staged, and one of those things that only our political class can do, you know, and think that they're looking good while they're doing it.
Well, thank you very much, Peter, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Neil.
All right, bye. Last time Matt Palumbo was on, he said that Republican Mike Gibbons was about to make his move. Here is our conversation about how the race for Ohio's Republican Senate nomination is going as we approach the May 3rd primary. Matt Palumbo, how are you, sir?
Neil, my friend, how are you doing?
Phenomenal and getting better every day.
That's right. I love that. That's your mantra.
So
everybody should try it.
So when you were on the podcast before, you said that Mike Gibbons was going to make his move, and he made his move big time. He spent a lot of money advertising on football playoff games. Did he have a Super Bowl ad?
He did.
Yeah. So yeah. talk about how TV was considered old-fashioned and stupid, and because of TV, Mike Gibbons is now number one in the Senate race for the Republican nomination, according to the Emerson poll.
That's right. And it's always nice to be right once in a while too, Neil. So, but yeah, I mean, Mike has been really used TV very aggressive over the last 3 or 4 months. And really, the people in Ohio know, they've seen the spots. They've told a story, Mike's story, where I think if you look at Mike 2 years ago in 18 when he ran for Senate, it was all, I'm a Trump business guy and an outsider. And certainly there's a lot of that in the narrative this time as well. But there's also, I mean, you mentioned football, the ads and the stories are all centered around Mike's time as a college football player and how it impacted his life and made him successful in business on the gridiron. And, he grew, and I think it's been successful because he started running it actually during football season. And then I think people just, you anecdotally, I think I hear more about these spots than I have anything in the 30 years I've been doing this. So I think it's obviously good for him. But yeah,
he has a great team too, putting his spots together.
He really does, and not to get down too far into the weeds, but yeah, I mean, the in politics, oftentimes it's the blockers and the tacklers and the operatives, and his team is really terrific. I mean, both, the guys that are doing the spots and the ads here in Ohio, and then his general consultant team, Mike Biondo, and who has got a lot of experience on the national level, is just doing really a terrific job. I mean, that's really what it's all about. And it's very competitive. As we talked about, Neil, the other candidates that are, and I know we're going to talk about them, it's like the dream team. I mean, everybody's got a great team, and it's been so competitive. And I'm a football guy, as you know, and I just think this is like two-a-days. It's been like double sessions. You know, this is where you're competing for the starting position. And this is what politics is all about. You know, you go and you fight hard and you compete, and then whoever wins that primary is better off for that general election in November when they take on the opposition. And, of course, it's going to be Tim Ryan.
Yeah, and Josh Mandel, who was really the front runner up until this Emerson poll, of course, very popular guy, very well-known guy, but he was never able to create separation between himself and the rest of the pack. Why is that?
Yeah, and I love Josh. I mean, Josh has really worked his way up, of course, did two tours in Iraq, Marine, and, you know, Josh was, where I grew up in Lyndhurst, Ohio, was actually my parents' old house councilman. I mean, that was his start in politics, and worked his way up and did a great job statewide, and has tremendous name ID, right? And I think Josh's challenge has been, it seems like right out of the gate, he hit his ceiling. And the one thing he has struggled with is raising money this time, which he's never had that problem before. But he's a tireless worker. I mean, he's people that have seen the Facebooks and, you know, his social media, you know, he's out there campaigning, and, you know, he's a hustler. I mean, he's working hard for it. But unfortunately, you mentioned it. I mean, his support has just been slowly eroding from the beginning, and I just think it's a function of there's just other people like a Gibbons, like a J.D. Vance, you know, even Jane Timken, who is not known as a candidate, more as an operative, And then obviously even Bernie Marino, who dropped out, people that came on that nobody knew, but were eager to learn about. And as they learned about these candidates, it eroded into Josh's support, and he's just been in a kind of a steady decline. I will say, though, that the latest ad, I think, is a terrific ad. And folks I know that are listening have probably seen it. It features his time in his two tours in Iraq as a Marine. And obviously what's going on, you know, here and in the world with this heightened awareness and sense of what's going on in foreign policy with Ukraine, it's sort of created a little bit of an opportunity, I think, for Josh, and the timing's been good with that spot. And, you know, I know they've been very aggressive with it around the state.
Now, Jane Timken, who, of course, was the Republican chairwoman in Ohio and took over after Matt Borges and that whole thing where, you know, in 2016, Trump was literally running against the Republican governor of Ohio and the party chairman. And Timken was able to sort of clear that out and really, really set it up so that, you know, Ohio's no longer even a battleground state. And Trump won Ohio handily, despite, like, people were telling me that Ohio was in play, and it just didn't make sense to me. And so I think Timken gets some credit for that. And she has just brought on some really, really big players. I think we'll start off with Rob Portman, the outgoing senator, endorsed her. How does that help or hurt her?
Well, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, really. And I think, you know, Jane and the campaign, and really Jane is, if you have a list of the, you know, top 5 or 10 people that have turned Ohio into Trump country, Jane is certainly near the top of the list. Obviously, the number one person on that list is Donald J. Trump. I mean, he's the person most responsible for turning Ohio into Trump country. But in terms of Portman, it's interesting. So Portman is obviously not a big, liked in the MAGA crowd. I mean, in Ohio, he's not identified as MAGA. He's more of a Chamber of Commerce, you know, country club Republican establishment type. But I think that endorsement really has helped Jane from a fundraising perspective. It taps in to that, those Chamber of Commerce donors, and that's where it helps with that. In terms of electorally with the base, and it actually would hurt, I think, but it's a calculus, obviously, that they made that they needed to do that. And I think it's been counterweighted, I think, by the second move, which I think you're going to bring up, which is really equally important with some of the other folks that she's brought on to the campaign.
Right. So I think person number two would be Kellyanne Conway, who, of course, was Trump's campaign manager at the end of the 2016 race, and then for 4 years served as White House counselor, absolutely tied in to Trump world. She joined Jane Timken, and maybe people thought that she was going to bring a Trump endorsement with her, but that didn't come. So Kellyanne, I think that's an endorsement that
that's
means,
huge.
Hey,
yeah.
You know, hey, we're legit.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, Kellyanne, she's in terms of going to question her credibility at all as it relates to MAGA. There's very few people that understand the base better than her. And that's obviously a huge win for Jane and a huge shot in the arm and huge momentum, because she's big league. I mean, Kellyanne, any state and union that she's going to go to, is going to make some major impact for the candidate and bring a lot of credibility to the Trump voters in the MAGA crowd, no question. And then she's one of the best pollsters in the country as well. So I think it's a huge, huge win for Jane, and really a huge shot in the arm, and could create some, or has created momentum for her campaign for sure.
Now, I consider Corey Lewandowski a friend. Like, we don't talk all the time, friend, but he's a friend, and he's always been good to me. And he and David Bossie joined the Timken campaign. My friend, Corey Lewandowski, would not talk to me about it because he's just going to let the press release stand, you know, speak for itself. But what does it mean to have Bossie and Lewandowski on that team?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's huge. I mean, it's huge. Similar to Kellyanne. I mean, those guys are top-notch operators that know the ins and outs of what the MAGA movement and America First is all about. I don't care if you're in Ohio or Alabama or Arkansas. It doesn't matter. I mean, you go to any state, those three are going to have an impact for the candidate that they're gonna work for. I mean, they just know, they get it. I've obviously worked for all three of them, and I can tell it's just a huge thing for Jane and the Timken campaign to have those three individuals now firmly in the corner, pushing the envelope for her and for the campaign to be the next senator from Ohio.
So there's still some room now between now and the May 3rd primary. I think it's fair to say that Matt Dolan probably will not be the nominee. J.D. Vance is a guy, though, who came in with all of this thunder. I saw him at CPAC. He gave an amazing address at CPAC. He sounded great. Do you think he'll be able to sort of get back into the top tier?
I don't. And I really, as we talked about in the past, I really like J.D. His story is great. I think as a party, we need to have folks like J.D. Vance in the movement, and running for office, running for high office. And he did give a great address at CPAC. But I just think that a couple things. One, there's an old adage in Ohio that you need to run statewide and lose one time before you almost get your in your stripes to be able to do that. I've never subscribed to that, but so you have that issue. But I think the other thing too is he just got off on the wrong foot, right? I think he could never overcome the the missteps back way back, and the MAGA movement remembers, Neil. So some of these, just the very tough language that he used to describe the president and the MAGA movement and calling some, the movement, there's racists in the movement. He called the president an idiot. I mean, it's just like you say these things and you just they're forever, right? You try to, there's no getting the toothpaste back into the tube. And I think that's really, so he's done a great job. So it's almost like I would see like Dolan and Vance almost like jockeying for a position for 2 years from now, right? When Sherrod Brown is up, those could be the two that are fighting for that nomination 2 years from now to take on Sherrod Brown. I think that could be, what's happening.
Well, it's fantastic, Matt. Brilliant as always. Thanks for being on the Ohio Star podcast.
Thanks, Neil. Take care, my friend. Bye-bye.
Biden's second address to Congress and his first State of the Union address is pretty much the most important event for him or any president in his administration will deal with every year. Here is my conversation with GOP strategist Brian H. Darling about how Biden did.
Brian, how are you, sir?
Good. How are you doing?
Fantastic. President Joseph R. Biden Jr. gave his State of the Union address Tuesday, went for about an hour. He had a laundry list of requests for Congress. He opened with an emotional plea to support Ukraine, which is about all they'll get from him. What are your takeaways and what were some of the highlights for you?
Well, there weren't that many highlights. I think that's the problem. I think people expected him to come in and kind of lay out his reason for voters to vote for Democrats in the fall. But we didn't hear much of that. We heard a lot of gaslighting about the economy, where he was making believe the economy is great when it's not, making promises about what he's going to do about inflation. The beginning of the speech was decent when he was talking about Ukraine, but then it just kind of went downhill from there. And my big takeaway was that the speech just seemed cobbled together by a bunch of different staffers with no unifying theme. It just kind of jumped all over the place. And I don't think it was a very inspiring speech, and I bet we'll all forget about it in a week.
Right. And so as someone who's put together speeches and communications for different senators and organizations. Talk about what your ear heard as like the staff work. Could you detect sort of the fighting back and forth where different factions in the Biden administration were trying to push their stuff forward?
Yeah, definitely. You could see it because he jumped from issue to issue with no transition in speech. Most times when you have a speech like that, you'll have somebody kind of pull the whole thing together and give it a unifying theme. But that didn't happen here. He was jumping all over the place, issue from issue to issue. And you could see that basically every paragraph was something that was dropped in by a different staffer, and it didn't really make much sense. And so, you know, you listen to the speech and your big takeaway is not much, because he was just checking the box on a bunch of different issues that he thought he had to talk about, you know, taking credit for a lot of what he sees as victories, you know, the infrastructure bill, and jumping all over the place and talking about, you know, Afghanistan, the Ukraine, and trying to put something together that would send a message to the American people that he's in charge and he's competent. But I just don't feel like he did a good job at all. I gave him very low grades in that speech. I just don't think it was a well thought out speech.
I read the transcript Wednesday morning, and you know, when you're in the speech and you're in the moment, you don't sort of pick up on what you're talking about. But I noticed all of the pushes, like, let's pass this, let's pass this, come on, guys, let's pass this. All that was like at the end, like almost like, oh, we forgot all the stuff they forgot to talk about. They just threw it at the bottom.
Yeah, that's right. And also, when he says pass this, pass this, the American people are smart. They know that Democrats control the House, Democrats control the Senate. So making believe that he can't get things passed is really not going to fly with the American people. And so, you know, he can say, oh, we need to do this and that, but everybody knows that Republicans are very likely to take over the House this fall and possibly take over the Senate. So when he's clamoring for Congress to do something, the likelihood of them doing what he's asking diminishes day by day as we get closer to the midterms. And then in the next Congress, it's not going to happen at all. So it just was a really empty speech. And when he's trying to reset from his very, very low poll numbers, this didn't do it. I think it did the opposite. One other thing to note is that his demeanor was not compelling. He did not give a compelling presentation and a strong presentation as somebody who's competent and in charge and a president of the United States that we can have confidence in. I just didn't see that come across at all.
I was in the hall for Obama's last State of the Union, and then I was there for all four of Trump's addresses to Congress. Trump's last State of the Union was some of the most entertaining time I've ever spent in my life. It was like a reality show. It was like a game show. It was, you know, and the staff, you could see the growth of the staff work. And plus, Trump himself is a performer. And Biden's been at this a while, you know, and so when he like stumbles over words, and then you wonder, you know, he says the Russian tanks are surrounding Kiev, but the Russians will never conquer the hearts and minds of the Iranians. I was like, the Iranians? Like, how do you make that mistake? Like, you're reading the speech, right? How do you read Ukraine and say Iranians?
Well, it's because it's as if he read the speech maybe once over before delivering it, and he clearly didn't write it himself. I mean, when you mentioned Donald Trump, think about the difference between the presentations. Donald Trump enjoyed every single second he was there giving his speech. They had a great moment with the late Rush Limbaugh that I think tugged at everybody's hearts. And it was entertaining and it was gripping, and you listened to it and you absorbed it. The exact opposite we heard with President Biden, because he seemed like he was rushing through it just to get to the end. He didn't have his heart in it. There was no real emotion when he was giving the speech. Even when he was interrupted, when Lauren Boebert kind of yelled at him, he didn't miss a beat. It's as if he was just on autopilot, just trying to get through it. And you think about the difference, you know, Trump enjoying every second up there and capturing the crowd, and, you know, the Democrats hooting and hollering at him and Republicans cheering. It was a very sedate and quiet audience for Joe Biden, because nobody was inspired by it.
Right. And, you know, you worked for Rand Paul. who I wouldn't call him a hawk, right? But nobody to invade Ukraine. And Biden really set this thing up. You know, it's like told Zelensky, don't worry about it, pal. Play tough. Don't give in. We're behind you, right? Zelensky asks for a no-fly zone. Biden and his State of the Union says, you know what? We're going to give we're going to create that no-fly zone. We will not allow any Russian planes to fly in American airspace. No Russian airlines or private jets will fly in America. There, take that, Putin.
Yeah, he's redefined the idea of a no-fly zone, and I think that was a missed opportunity. I mean, he should have talked about Afghanistan. I mean, he's claimed repeatedly it's one of his great achievements, but he didn't mention it during his speech. But even the Ukraine stuff, I mean, there was an important moment where Jill Biden hugged the ambassador from the Ukraine. I thought that was a good moment, but he didn't spend enough time talking about it, explaining what we're going to do, what we can do, what he wants Congress to do to give him a new supplemental. There just wasn't enough there. He should have spent more time talking about that, more time talking about inflation and how he is going to dig in and get it done. Instead, he just jumped issue over and over. Every minute he was jumping on a new issue, just trying to check a box, and none of it got through. None of it really, I don't think any of those messages really got through to the American people. It was a very, very forgettable speech.
Last thing, Brian, you know, you worked on the Hill for many, many years, and you know, to my mind, the legislative season, the real productive legislative season, is State of the Union is your kickoff, and you have until the July 4th recess if you want to get anything done. And from July 4th on, it's just garbage time. Do you think Biden can get anything done between now and July 4th recess?
I mean, I think he'll get a Ukraine supplemental and, you know, the government funded, but that's about it. Build Back Better is dead in the water. His push for this so-called voting rights bill, which is a federalization of our election system, that's dead in the water. They're not passing. And he's acting like he's in the minority and he's in the minority party when he's Democrat. We have a Democrat president. We have Democrats controlling the House and Senate, but he's acting like he's running against Washington. Nobody's going to believe that. He's not going to get anything passed, and he's not giving the American people a compelling reason to go to the polls this fall and vote for Democrats in the House and Senate.
Well, thank you very much, Brian, for coming on the Ohio Star podcast. Where can people find you on the Twitter?
It's at Brian H. Darling on Twitter.
Fantastic. Talk to you later, man.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. That really helps.
Hey, no problem.
All right. See you later.
Okay, bye.
Brian Lanier, who handles state affairs for Citizens Against Government Waste, is a recent college graduate, but he is carrying on a long tradition, really a legacy, of Peter Grace and the Grace Commission. He talked to me about a data privacy bill that Citizens Against Government Waste is concerned about.
Joining us now is Ryan Lanier from Citizens Against Government Waste. Ryan, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you?
Fantastic. Now, you were once an intern for Citizens Against Government Waste. How did you start with this organization, and tell us what your job is with them now?
Yeah, so I first started here in 2018 as an intern. I did research in federal government affairs and did some policy work. Graduated from college last May, and after another internship out in Arizona, I was looking for a job and saw the state government affairs job opened up here at CAGW, and I loved it so much that I decided to throw an offer at it. They remembered me and thought I did a good enough job that they hired me back. So that's how I ended up getting back here. Right now, I cover anything that we do in the states. Our big issues now are data privacy, healthcare issues, some environmental issues, and dealing with all the federal grant money that the government just keeps pouring out there.
This was a little before your time, but when I was a boy in short trousers, I was a huge fan of Peter Grace and the Grace Commission that was set up by President Ronald Reagan. and he did this phenomenal, like, I don't want to say autopsy, but he did this amazing study of how the federal government wastes money and taking all of the lessons of, you know, from the private sector and just modern management, because so much of the government and government systems are designed more than 100 years ago. And of course, this was even true in the 1980s. And, you know, Peter Grace, you know, even the Republicans, you know, shut him down. And it was, but he kept going. He started your organization to keep that legacy going. And sort of talk to me about that spirit of Peter Grace that still lives with your organization.
Yeah, no, that's definitely still the central to what Citizens Against Government Waste is about. Our president, Tom Schatz, in the internship, when I came back, it's always like making sure that we're sticking to the message and the mission that Peter Grace had, and what he wanted is like bringing this stuff to light and making sure that the people know and the people are holding their representatives and holding the federal government accountable. And that's central to what he believed, and that's central to what we believe now.
Well, of course, Ryan, this is the Ohio Star podcast, and I understand there's some data privacy legislation that you are monitoring. So what is the bill, and what's the story there, Brian?
Yeah, so this bill that we're keeping an eye on is HB 376. It's currently in a House committee, waiting to see if they're going to take it up again. But what it does is it's going to impose restrictions on violations from data brokering of consumer information. This is anything that you do on the internet, when you make a sale, you buy something, interact with anybody on the internet, this is regulating that and making sure that people's privacy is protected and they have certain rights are protected on this. And where we're concerned about this, obviously we care about people's privacy being protected and we want to make sure that we want to get rid of these violations of data on data brokering. Our concern is we want a national framework because when you look at the internet, it crosses these state borders, and anything that crosses the state borders, that's a federal issue. The Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, that falls to Congress, not to the states. And we just want to make sure that Ohio and all these other states are not putting in this piecemeal approach that really isn't going to work and takes away from Congress's authority.
Fantastic. Ryan, where can people find Citizens Against Government Waste on Twitter, and where can they find you on Twitter?
I believe our Twitter handle is at GovWaste. Yep. So go on Twitter, at GovWaste, follow us. We'll put out a lot of information on this, and you can go to our website where we write a lot about this. You can see our letters. You can see our various blog posts on this, cagw.org.
Thanks a lot, Ryan. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me on the Ohio Star podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our weekly programs that drop Thursdays. And also, please remember to leave a positive review on iTunes or wherever you are hearing me now, because it helps other people find the podcast. I am Reporter McCabe on Twitter, and you can send me news tips at neilwmccabe@thestarnewsnetwork.com. Until next time, this is Neil W. McCabe reporting for the Ohio Star.